Hello everyone, my name is Colin Detmar of Scanline Media, and welcome back to part two of our Persona 4 episodes of Investigation Team. I'm joined, of course, by Jennifer Uncle.
Hey there.
And so last episode, our first episode on Persona 4, we sort of covered the systems and setting and sort of the, what would you say, the atmosphere of Persona 4?
I'd say so, yeah, just mainly the whole Japanese school life thing that it has going on, also being a much smaller town than what people are typically used to.
Mm-hmm. And so this episode, which may or may not be the last episode, I guess we're going to see at the end of this how we feel, but we're going to be mostly talking about the just deep diving on the characters of Persona 4 and Persona 4 Golden, though Golden only added one genuinely new character, and we're not super interested in that character. But we're going to start off with the original, the MC himself, Yu Narukami, who is, of course, our party leader. Jen, will you take this one?
Sure, yeah. Yu's basically, you don't really get much about his backstory other than he typically lives in the city, and he had to abandon all his friends just to come over here for the summer. And, yeah, it's one of those things where you don't really, most of the details that you get about him are through the dialogue options you're given and some of the self-narration, like Khan talked about with that TV channel, that TV shopping channel. And, yeah, he's kind of mostly a blank slate, and his whole persona, basically the persona of being, I believe, the Joker, right? Because it mm-hmm. can be anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's the one character in the game that can pretty much switch between any persona at will. So he's basically something. I feel like his thing is that his neutrality sort of brings out the reality of the other characters, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think that he's sort of like a, to a certain extent, people see in him what they want to see in him, and he's sort of willing, I would say willing would be the Persona 3 protagonist. You is actually kind of happy to play along with that. He wants to see who you are, and he's happy to be what you need to see it.
Yeah, he mostly takes a backseat while the other characters get to express themselves, and basically just being there without standing out too much helps them with that.
Mm-hmm. So, we're not going to talk too much about people's personas right now. I guess, yeah, we're definitely going to have to do a third episode, because talking about some of the stuff with the actual persona themselves is a whole thing, but it is worth noting that Yu Narukami's like primary persona is Izanagi, which is the Japanese god of creation. Yeah, that's not an accident. Very few things in this game are. I think the interesting thing to note, like there are multiple things about him that are interesting, but one of the things that I find the most interesting is the fact that he's the only member of the investigation team who doesn't ever meet his shadow self. He doesn't ever, like, he doesn't have that moment of self-actualization where he gets his persona. He just, like, he gets in a position where he needs his persona, and he just calls it. And obviously it is the first time he has done it, and he's very surprised, but it's just there. And I'm curious, I have a theory on this myself, and I guess I'll present it to you, which is, like, one perspective would be that maybe he already overcame whatever issues he had, or enough issues, previously to the story starting, but my theory would actually be more that it's because he's the player character, because he has the guiding hand of the person on the other side of the screen, that he already sort of knows his path. What do you think about that?
Well, I feel like that's more of a game design sort of explanation than a narrative sort of explanation, which is fine, but I always kind of saw it as, since he happened to go through that without all the other characters that have very specific personas fused to them, basically go through trauma to have that happen. Mm-hmm. They're basically stuck within that same serial killer loop of someone trying to kidnap and then murder them in the TV world. And I feel like that's that sort of thing, basically because their shadow ends up being bound within this form, it means that that's basically their persona for as long as they have that part of themselves within them.
Sure, but the fact that he doesn't, like... I mean, Yosuke isn't kidnapped. Yosuke just goes in of his own free will, and then his shadow comes out, right? So, like, clearly people who just go in can also meet their shadow selves. That's a thing.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
And also, Chie isn't kidnapped either. So, I think it's, I mean, it has to be, like, it can't, I don't think it's just that they weren't kidnapped. I think it has to be something different on a psychological level, or spiritual level, or whatever, with you, as opposed to everyone else.
Are we going to go into how he does have a shadow character in the fighting games, or does that not count?
I mean, they specific, like, it, they are, art in the fighting games, they are artificially created. Like, there is a person in the fighting, like, the story of the fighting games is certainly better than most fighting games, and it is canon, but they are also going out of their way to create a fighting game situation. So, like, there's a person who can make shadow versions of you regardless of your internal conflict. It's not a representation of, like, could make a, that, like, the villain in the Persona 4 Arena series could make a shadow version of Mother Teresa. It's not, you know, it's not a thing. So I don't think that, like, that's worth bringing up, but I don't think it changes my view of the situation.
Okay.
So I don't know. Yeah, I personally think, I mean, like, there's, I don't think it's a coincidence, like, all right, diving a little more into Persona as a series, you know, the save points are the blue butterflies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are actually the representation of a, I don't know if he's a god or just a really powerful being. It's kind of unclear. But so those butterflies are sort of a sign of the presence of Philemon, who is, yeah, like a very powerful entity in the Persona world who seems to be setting people up to save the world, right? Like, Igor is a servant of Philemon. The Velvet Room is his thing. So, like, obviously, Philemon, that entity from the Persona universe, is involved, and he's choosing people who are the protagonists of these series. And I feel like that's, like, I don't know if the player, like, you know, I'm overanalyzing. I don't know if the player is supposed to be, like, Philemon's will or if it's a different thing. But I think it's not just that these were people who were already ready. I think there's an outside influence going on.
Oh, I see. So instead of being chosen, as in it's a convenient thing for the developers, you were saying that it's chosen by the specific god, essentially.
Right. I mean, I think it's actually, it's not just like, hey, this would be easier on us. I think it's actually part of the series' lore and history.
Okay.
That this is happening to them. I think. I don't know. I mean, like, there's no, the game doesn't comment on it one way or another, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think they're sort of building towards all of these teams coordinating together at some point, or is that...
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised by a Persona 5 arena, I guess. But I don't think they're interested in connecting them in, like, in their main games. Like, I mean, if nothing else, like, the way, like, in Persona 4 Arena, it establishes, like, okay, it's been, and also in Persona 3 Portable, it establishes that these characters have an age gap, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, by the time the investigation team is out and about, the protagonists of Persona 3 are in college. Or not in college, as the case may be, which is also a thing. But, like, I assume that's going to be the case again with Persona 5. I think they're just trying to set up a framework in which they can tell these stories and have them have some overarching significance. But I don't think they're looking to create like a game, like a Persona All-Stars, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's what they're going for.
Maybe they're hoping for a movie deal where they basically turn into the Avengers or something.
I mean, they've had movie deals already. I don't know. I just think it's a convenient way for them to do things. I don't think they have any plans to unite things.
Makes sense.
I guess we should move on to Yosuke though, because we don't like there's more stuff to say about you, but a lot of it like you is not a blank slate, but there's not a lot written on there, and that's on purpose, and they want the player to fill in some things. So I take any representations in like Persona 4 Arena, for instance, with a grain of salt. Because another part of it is that a lot of the characters in that are a little exaggerated often for the sake of comedy and stuff, and it's not, you can't read too much off of all of that. So there's just not too much for us to discuss. But with Yosuke Hanamura, there is more concrete. So Yosuke is, he is, as we mentioned before, the son of a manager of a jeunesse. He's from the city. And he
is a jerk.
He's kind of a jerk. And that's like, he's been treated poorly by his peers. And, you know, anybody knows that kids are great. I like kids, but also kids can be really pretty cruel and pretty mean. And it's pretty common for kids who have been bullied to then pass that along, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Yosuke certainly gets some harassment for his being an outsider and, you know, quote-unquote, you know, like, destroying the sleepy town. Oh, your father is such a bad person, therefore you're a bad person, blah, blah, blah. And throughout the game, he kind of passes this along to the rest of the crew. And he's not, like, I don't know. I have a lot of problems with Yosuke as a character in this game. I don't think he's a bad thing to be in this game. And I don't even think the fact that he passes along the poor treatment that he's been given is always a bad thing. Like, you know, he's kind of like condescending and manipulative towards the girls, and that's not awesome to watch, but it's like, no, yeah, I guess that's what this guy would do.
Yeah.
But his treatment of Kanji goes over the line for me.
Yeah, it's just so, he just acts constantly scared and paranoid of this really good friend who just wants to be included, who has spent a lot of his life just sort of like Yosuke, kind of being rejected, and, mm-hmm. and kind really, of owning that rejection in a way.
But, and it's just really like blatant open homophobia. Like a lot of the other times that he is kind of a jerk, it's kind of like, oh buddy, like this is passive aggressive, you probably don't even realize you're doing this. There's no way he couldn't be aware of what he was doing with Kanji.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you can't sleep in here with us, we might be in trouble or something. Like he would secretly do something.
I think, like, there is the exact quote, are we safe around you? It's like, fuck you.
Yeah.
It's really, like, there's no gray area. He's just being a dickhead. I don't know. It's, like, and the fact that the rest of the investigation team is quiet when this happens, like, nobody ever is like, Yosuke, the fuck is wrong with you? I feel like the most generous interpretation is that it's that thing where, like, you know, someone is being shitty and their friends are just quietly like, boy, this is uncomfortable, but doesn't want to say anything because they are afraid they'll make it worse. That's the generous reading. I think more likely it's just that Japan isn't as socially in line with what, you know, with the values that Jen and I, and I think a lot of Americans are with these days, with, you know, equal treatment and not liking homophobia and transphobia and all these, like, you know, Japan is kind of behind the times on social progress, you know? That's not news.
Yeah. I've also kind of been in similar situations with that he's thrust into where there'll be someone being a jerk and everyone's just kind of quiet. So that's that kind of feels true to life, but
sure. But like part of the power, like okay, I write fiction in my free time. Don't ask me if you can read any of that. The answer is no. But the beauty of being a fiction writer is that you can choose to represent anything you want, and you can also choose not to. Like, yes, it's realistic for someone to be a dickhead and his friends to be quiet about it because they're uncomfortable, but you chose that. You've got to take responsibility for that, you know?
Yeah, totally.
And that's, you know, it's kind of like the Bayonetta argument, but that's another, you know, maybe that's another podcast. We'll see. But like, yeah, his like he's being shitty and the rest of the investigation team is quiet. And that's kind of realistic, but that's also on the writers because it's also realistic for, like, I've done it to friends. Roz, like, hey, fucking knock it off. That's a thing that real people do. You chose not to have them do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I guess we sort of have this order that we were going to talk about things in, but we're going to skip around as is necessary because I really feel like we kind of need to talk about Kanji now.
Yeah. Kanji is more or less a character sort of, well, when you meet him at first, he's kind of considered the bad school bully of sorts. Like, he's the one that's constantly skipping class. He's sort of initially portrayed as a bit of an airhead, and basically he's someone that the team kind of avoids for a bit, but when they do end up going to rescue him, they and he sort of realize that he's a bit different than the others. He kind of struggles with how his interests are different than other typical guys in his neighborhood, and he's also kind of struggling with his sexuality a bit, and they never really, I don't think there's ever a moment where they definitively say he is one thing or another, but it's definitely one of those situations where, back when I played it, there weren't a lot of queer characters that were in video gaming that weren't treated as a joke in some way, and just having Kanji as this sympathetic sort of character that they kind of respect as, and they initially kind of look to as a scary outsider, but then they kind of end up respecting him for his differences, even if that doesn't extend to also to his sexuality, that that really stuck with me at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, like, I mean, if you know Japanese, like, media tropes, Kanji is sort of the classic Bansho. He's, like, the high school thug, kind of. Not, like, a bully, exactly, but just, like, you know, the tough guy who's trying to prove something. And his whole thing, you know, like, as Jen says, like, the game presents it like he's gay. That's sort of his shadow conflict. And then, you know, the resolution of his shadow conflict is that he's like, well, listen, there's a lot of me that's not, like, super masculine, and I've got some confidence issues about that, but I'm not gay. And that resolves his issue with his shadow, so he's not gay, you know? Like, he's more effeminate, and he has different interests, and he is trying to figure things out, and I thought that was pretty relatable. But, like, yeah, the game does a really, really poor job of explaining his situation, but basically his situation is Kanji met Naoto and was attracted to Naoto. At the time, Naoto was pretending to be male, and Kanji's like, well, I'm clearly attracted to this person. This person is a guy. What does that mean? Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, oh, Naoto isn't actually a guy. And, you know, you can get into sort of like, well, you thought she was, so what does that mean? But as far as he's concerned, it's like, oh, okay, Naoto wasn't actually a guy. I like women. That's fine. And, yeah, the game communicates that incredibly poorly. And it doesn't like, 100% make sense, because, as I say, like, well, if you thought someone was male and were still, like, super into them, then maybe that says something. Who knows? And then also just there's the part where, like, yeah, like, you said, like, it was rare to see characters who were gay and not treated as a joke, but he kind of is. Like, he's a relatable character who is respected at times, but also, like, Yosuke's harassment of him is supposed to be comedic, and it's not. It's awful. And, like, the game does make jokes about how, like, blunt or stupid he is, right? I mean, they don't tend to make that many jokes about the fact that he is not gay-ish. I don't know. There's what, like, the game presents him as being very much like a gay person without actually being gay, and it's really weird and clumsy and uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's, there's probably, well, I don't know whether I should even bring this up or something, because it's a whole other bag of things that we could probably spend 5 minutes talking about, but the whole cross-dressing pageant where they really go over the top with Kanchi. It's kind of set up as a Marilyn Monroe dress, and yeah, it's a situation where it compounded with the conversations they've had before about his questions about sexuality, it kind of feels tasteless.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. I mean, it's, yeah, there's an opportunity in the game. Well, not an opportunity. There is a situation in which you are required to participate in a cross-dressing contest along with Yosuke and Kanji. And I feel like mostly that's really, like, uncomfortable because of how they handle it. Like, there's not a lot of consent going along in this process in a way that's uncomfortable. Except for as you, like, you have, like, three potential responses to the situation, and one of them is you being like, hell yeah, let's do it, which, of course, I chose because, you know, come on. But that whole thing is really uncomfortable, and it's not uncomfortable because it's a cross-dressing contest. I've been to cross-dressing contests, and they were kind of rad. Some of the outfits were amazing. People looked beautiful. It's uncomfortable because it's sort of like these three people doing a thing that they are, like, essentially being blackmailed into doing by the rest of the party. And it's, you know, there's sort of a concept of turnabout is fair play because earlier Yosuke enters all the female characters into a different contest. And they're sort of like, well, we're going to get revenge on you guys. And it's all really uncomfortable. I like...
Yeah, and compounding that is also the audience members who are basically saying stuff like when Teddy comes out and blows them all out of the water and in Alice in Wonderland cosplay, they're like, someone yells out, I'd hit that. And it's like, this is not going great.
Well, and also it's worse because I think it's worse with the other characters, like especially like Kanji and Yosuke, because the response to them is a bunch of people being like, oh, I feel sick. It's like, fuck you.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess Teddy does come off the best in that because he's just super eager to do it, and everyone's just kind of like, yeah, you go.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, if you play you a certain way, people are kind of, like, it's not a great reaction, but it is better than the rest of the party gets, where you're just, like, super into it, and everyone's like, huh, okay, I guess you're super into this. And that's, like, again, not an amazing reaction, but compared to the, like, I feel sick reactions, it's better. That whole thing is just...
questionable.
Yeah, it's a, like, it's 15 minutes of the game putting its foot in its mouth, and not just, like, because it's clumsy. It's like, oh, you're really showing that you guys have some unpleasant biases and bigotry, and it's unpleasant to watch.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I do think that's important to tie into Kanji's situation because that's really the issue is like, and it's one of the, I don't want to talk too much about Persona 5, but I've heard that in that game there is an issue of rape brought up, and I do not trust Japanese developers to handle that with respect.
Oh no,
I just don't trust them for that.
Yeah, I did not know that was going to happen in Persona 5, and now I'm super bummed out. Ugh.
Well, I mean, I don't know how major of a mention it is. I don't know what the reaction is. I know very little. I don't want to overthink it, but yeah, like, I don't want to turn this into a political podcast, but I think the as far as like social progress, Japan has some serious catching up to do, and in a lot of their games they remind us of how far behind they are, and it's not great to see.
Yeah, and that's not going to be the last time we talk about this on this specific podcast episode either.
No, it is not. But for the moment, I think we should probably move on to Chie. So Chie is a character whose issues I find pretty relatable. You know, I think all of these characters, most people can relate to a lot of these characters' issues in some way. People, like, it's nice that in this game, they boil people down to having one primary issue. Because that's a lot easier to design a story around and characters around. But, like, boy, fucking real life humans have so many goddamn issues, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're all a mess. But Chie's one big issue is that she's a passive-aggressive manipulator, right? She is tied with one other character, maybe ahead of the other character, in terms of being the most emotionally manipulative. And her emotional manipulation, like, we don't know where it comes from. Maybe it's just sort of inherent to her personality. Maybe she picked it up from her family. We don't know. But, like, Chie is a person who does not have great self-esteem or a great self-image. And in order to feel better about herself, she manipulates people into feeling bad about themselves as well. Her friendship with Yukiko is kind of based around the fact that she dunks on Yukiko constantly so that Yukiko feels really self-conscious and relies on Chie because Chie is, like, always there for her, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, like, it's really well done, I think. And I don't, like, it's gross, but it's gross in the way it should be. Because, like, boy, that's a... My family does this sort of thing a lot. This is a thing that I will do a lot. And I, like, I'll be in a situation where I'm talking to someone, and I'm, like, I'll ask them a question, and I'm, like, okay, I already know the answer to this question, and they already know the answer to this question. Am I just asking them to remind them of something that will make them feel bad so they can take it? Boy, that's shitty, you know? And you just catch yourself doing these things without thinking. And that's Chie all over. And like everyone else, like, one of the things that I like in this game is that when people confront their shadows and make up with them, that doesn't mean they stop doing the thing. It doesn't mean the problem is gone. It means that they're aware of it and they're working on it. But they still totally show signs of this problem. Chie is still pretty manipulative for most of the game, and not, like, in an awful way, in sort of a fairly normal way, I guess. But, like, boy, she gets a lot out of Yosuke through guilt-tripping and saying, hey, you owe me from this thing, or hey, remember that thing, you know?
Yeah, like, that Trial of the Dragon DVD that ends up being... I feel like that went on for quite a bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's what that sort of person does, right? It's like, no, like, you still owe me from this. You will always owe me for this, you know? Is sort of the attitude. And it's shitty, you know?
Yeah.
And I sympathize with Chie for struggling with this in the same way that I get angry at her for doing it, you know? And I think it's really, I don't know, it's of all the characters, hers is the one that seems the most
relatable.
She's the second most relatable, but the most, like, realistically awful, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, oh man, it's just sort of built into you be a dick to your friends, and that's really hard. That really sucks for you and for your friends, and no one wins here, you know?
Yeah. Meanwhile, we have, if we're gonna move on now and stuff, we have, sure. Yukiko, which, she's not really close to as interesting as Chie is, but in a sort of relationship like that, there was always going to be at least one person who sort of takes more of a backseat, and it's the person that gets constantly ripped on. And her thing is basically she comes from a lineage of family who is really into running this specific hotel/spa. And it's one of those situations where she's there and her family seems to be putting a lot of pressure on her to continue the tradition. And it's not just her family, like the local news, which if anyone gets portrayed the absolute worst in this, it's probably the news, which is constantly just ripping on these characters. It's a situation where people are like, oh wow, you're hot, I hope you keep running this hotel, yeah, that'd be great. It's almost kind of like your obligation, huh? And you can just see that sort of thing tear away at her, like when she has to skip school to help out during a busy time, and she basically ends up putting everything else in her life aside for this spa in some respects, and that just kind of tears away at her until she kind of feels like she wants to explode a bit.
Yeah, and like, I mean, she gets faced with the most, like, the most misogyny in the game, mostly through the news, because she's on the news some. She gets interviewed and people are just like, wow, you're sexy, you should, yeah, this is great. She's like, hi, I'm a person, we could interact as people do, or you could keep being a creep. And you know, like, she has issues of like, you know, her self-image and her self-confidence, partially because of Chie. Because Chie spends a lot of time being like, oh, that's Yukiko, she's so beautiful and she's so perfect, and oh my god, it's Yukiko. And, you know, fucking, like, of course that'd make you self-conscious, because it's like, oh shit, what if something I do isn't completely perfect? So, good job there, Chie. But also, yeah, there's just the, like, everyone expects me to take over this inn, everyone expects me to do the right thing, everyone expects me to be this perfect girl, and I'm sick of it, right? And that's relatable to an extent, but, like, the problem, like, the reason I don't find her that interesting is that her problem is, oh, no, you're nice and you don't like it when people are shitty. And it's like, well, yeah, that's not a problem, you know?
Yeah. Like,
everyone has their moment where they shout, no, that's not true, at their shadow when their shadow is talking. And Yukiko's shadow is like, it seems kind of lame that I'm expected to run this business and I don't really have any choice in my future. And Yukiko's like, that's not me! It's like, that's super reasonable. I don't know. I feel like, I don't know, maybe it says more that she thinks that's a big problem, right? Maybe the problem is not the problem. The problem is that she thinks it's a problem. But I don't know.
Yeah, her priorities are a bit skewed, more or less.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a level of death of the artist going on here, right? Because I don't think what they intended is too relevant to what they put out, you know? Like, our reading of Yukiko is what it is, and what they wanted to say, well, this is what they said. I don't care what they wanted to say that much. But it would interest me if this is, like, if they intended it to be, like, here's this woman not accepting her place in the world as being, I don't know. Let me put it, like, the way they treat some other characters does not make me want to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah, the shadow stuff especially, it just so happens to be with most of the female characters kind of super hypersexualized, and
and with Kanji's as well. And I mean, I guess, like, the only male shadows we see are Mitsuo's, who we'll get to eventually, and Yosuke's. And Yosuke's is just like, I feel like Yosuke's shadow is the most actually like him, right? Like, everyone's shadow is like a distortion of themselves. And Yosuke's is just him talking without a filter. Yosuke's is just him being like, I'm a fucking dickhead. It's like, yeah, you kind of are.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I do think, yeah, they do sexualize Kanji, but Kanji's gay, so of course they're going to fucking show him in a sexual way as well, because...
Yeah, and they play it as a joke while once again, using Yosuke as an example, he's super excited when he sees all the Risei stuff happening, but as soon as that happens to Kanji, he's like, ew, what, no, we don't want to go in there.
Yeah, it's... We will try not to dwell too much on the troubling aspects that we've already established, but boy, it's hard not to, you know?
Yeah.
So the next party member that you get is Risei, and boy, I have a lot of thoughts about Risei. I made the notes a real mess with my thoughts on Risei. Okay. Risei's problem. Risei is an idol. You know, in Japan, there's the phenomenon of young teenage girls becoming, you know, pop idols, pop stars, and, you know, the cult of personality around them, and they're on TV, and they're on TV on ads, and they're, you know, like, at concerts, and everyone's like, oh my god, she's so cute, and I love her, and blah blah blah, right? And she is an idol who is taking a break from the idol business to just be a normal person because she needs some time. And her issue is that because she's been acting both like as a profession and just sort of as a thing for so long, she's lost sight of what it means to be her real self. She does acting as in, like, she's in commercials and she's on TV, and that's literal paid acting. But also, like, well, there's this personality of Rosette, the idol, and when she meets a fan, she sort of has to kick into this idol personality. And then, like, well, you know, she's trained as a people pleaser. Like, when you become an idol, it's you have to do a lot of training, and it's not just singing and dancing. It is training you to, like, appeal for cameras and, like, make people like you by being maybe a little more, like, cute and grossly a little bit more sexual than you normally would be. And just, like, all of that has been trained into her to a point where it's subconscious, where she does it without thinking. And when she wants to turn all that stuff off, she doesn't know how. And also, if she was able to, like, would that be the real her? Or does the fact that she can't turn it off mean that that's not the real her anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so she comes to the realization, what she decides when she makes her resolution with her shadow is that there's no such thing as a real her. And I think, I mean, like, this is the one I identify with the most. Like, I am also a people pleaser, right? That is my personality type. I'm also social butterfly is the way people phrase it. And I think in my case, that's too flattering. But, like, the way I behave and the way I talk and the way I think is going to shift based on who's in the room to a degree that sometimes is kind of troubling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's her problem as well. So it's just the issue of, like when you are first getting her into the party and you're sort of talking with her and you're about to go take care of a task and she flirts pretty aggressively with you. With you, Narukami, the main character. And that's fine. Obviously, if she wants to flirt with you, that's great, right? But it feels practiced. You know, it feels like she's flirting because it's like, oh, this is a young boy, and, like, therefore I will flirt. Because she doesn't even know you yet. She, like, you can like someone at first sight, that's a thing, sure. But I don't think the game shows much indication of that. It's just sort of like, oh, well, time to use that idol charm, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird because I will not do too much praising of Laura Bailey here, right? But Laura Bailey's voice work for Risei is so fucking phenomenal. It is her best performance by far. Otherwise, I don't even, like, I think she's good, but I don't even, she's not a voice actress I follow. But the job she does as Risei is amazing because of all the different sides of Risei that she shows. She shows the idol side. She shows the sort of, like, trying to be normal but having some of the idol bleed in. And she shows, like, trying really aggressively to be normal, which is when you first meet her. and she's working at her, I think, her grandma's tofu shop, and she's, like, dressing super plainly, and she's, like, talking, not, like, monotone, but, like, super unenthusiastically, and she's, like, actively trying so hard not to be an idol, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of rambling, but I think it's really, like, I empathize a lot with the idea of trying to figure out, like, what combination of, like, how you want to appear to people and how you see yourself in private and what you aspire to be and what combination of that is you. I don't know. I find it all very sympathetic and incredibly well executed.
Yeah, it's kind of along the similar lines, just growing up with autism, I kind of had to spend a lot of time just practicing certain social cues and learning how to recognize and respond, and more to a people sort of just normally, just naturally, they kind of pick that up as they go along, but I kind of had to have it taught in a school-like session sometimes, and it's one of the situations where I kind of feel like I sort of repress certain parts of myself just to be agreeable and not stand out as autistic sometimes. And yeah, it's one of those situations where I actually wrote an article about this sort of in regards to the Moon and them talking about how you kind of feel like a robot at sometimes. But yeah, eventually it's just one of those situations where I've come to realize that it's okay to sort of branch out of that somewhat now that I have that sort of thing down pat. And it's just taken longer than usual to accept that there can be multiple parts of myself without thinking that I'm totally throwing myself away, if that makes any sense.
No, totally. And I think, like, that's a part of it is figuring out, like, I mean, I do think there are, like, you know, the concept of persona in psychology is, you know, represented by masks, right? And of course that's also how it's represented in the series. And there is a concept, like, there is a degree to which, like, there can be some persona that are not healthy or not really you because they're really forced. But it is natural to have a lot of different faces that you show people, right? And it's the only person who can make the decision as to whether they're you or not is you. Like, there, you know, if you listen to my different podcasts that I've been on, you will see different versions of me, right? I am trying to be kind of intellectual here. I don't know if I'm succeeding, but I am trying. If you listen to my Dota podcast, you will listen to me be a lot more, like, passionate and kind of illogical because I'm trying to be entertaining and funny, right? And I don't think either of those, like, neither of those are not me. They're all genuine sides of myself, and it's just what you choose to show. And that's kind of the realization that she comes to along the way. Like, first she figures out that there's no such thing as a real her. And then she refines that statement to be like, there's no such thing as one real me. There are lots of real me's, and it's what I choose to present. And so she gets out of the idol business, and at the end of her thing, like, she has like, she's feeling great about, like, thank God I'm out of all of that. And then she's like, well, but I became an idol because I love that, right? Because I love singing, I love dancing, I love the audience, I love to perform. And she starts sort of missing that part of her life. And she decides, like, she figures out, like, no, it's fine. Like, I want to still have a part of my life that is not the idol, but I want to go back to that. And actually, she is the one character who gets genuine development in the Persona 4 Arena series. Because in Persona 4 Arena Ultimax, the second one of those, she becomes a playable character. And the reason is that she's now, like, act as she's back being an idol again. And, like, once again, there's a catastrophe and she's like, fucking shit, I need to get in touch with the guys and, you know, like, give them radio support. And then she stops and she's like, no. Actually, you know what? I think I want to take care of this myself.
Yeah, that's a pretty great moment.
Yeah, it's a good moment for that character. don't know. I feel like the problem with the way we've set this up is that now we're going to talk about Teddy.
I guess Teddy's kind of a weird one because he's introduced to the party a lot sooner than pretty much any... Well, sooner than anyone other than Yosuke. And he's just kind of this person that's already been hanging out and living in the shadow world for a while. And you come along and it kind of... He feels really apprehensive about it at first. Like, what are you doing in here? But then he realizes, oh, wait, there's this other terrible person that's kind of throwing a bunch more people in here, and I'm not happy with that because I like my solitude. But as you kind of get acquainted with him, and he throws a bunch of bear puns around and constantly tries to flirt with the female party members because that's just kind of his thing, he gets lonelier and lonelier whenever you're away for a bit, and it gets to a point where he has his own sort of shadow that is basically a nihilistic sort of, what's the point? No one really loves me. I'm just this person that they take advantage of, and then they'll probably throw me away when I'm gone. Or they no longer have use for me.
Mm-hmm. Like, I've talked about a few of the characters being people pleasers. They got nothing on Teddy. Teddy is the clingiest motherfucker in the world. It was not my dog, but I used to live with a dog by the name of Pablo. And Pablo got a little better about this as he got older. But he just had the worst separation anxiety. If you left the house for any reason, he would immediately run to the window and start whining. And he would just freak out basically the whole time you were gone. You'd come back and he'd like jumped on the table and done a little dance because he was just losing his mind because he had such bad separation anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Teddy all over. Like he doesn't jump on the table and do a little dance usually, but he just like for a character who's set up being like, hey, I want you guys to get this done with so you'll stop bothering me, like so quickly becomes so attached to the party and just like terrified of being left alone. And that's kind of, you know, like, his is not the most, like, he's not human, he's a shadow. So his arc is acceptably the least human, right? His arc is kind of, like, he's got a little Schrodinger's thing going on. Like, well, I was just a mindless shadow, and these people came in here and started paying attention to me, and I've developed into kind of a person. And, oh God, what if they stop looking at me and I go back to that?
Yeah, and I don't really know the nature of his actual human form when that eventually comes around, but it kind of actually, instead of getting... Well, I guess he had a shadow because... Well, I guess the part of him becoming part of a human was just getting separated from his shadow in a way. And it's one of those interesting things where you can tell how much happier he is when he's in human form and just hanging around with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Did they ever set up that he could actually stay that way, or...
What, stay as a person?
Yeah.
He is just a person. Like, basically, what happened was his suit was hollow, and then he kind of grew a person inside of there, and now his suit is a suit.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that...
And he really likes the suit, but it's a suit.
Yeah. I was kind of unclear about that stuff a bit.
Yeah, it's all kind of weird, of course, because it's like a manifestation of people's inner thoughts becoming its own person, and of course his whole arc is strange. I don't know. I personally find him one of the least relatable characters, I guess.
He's mostly adorable. Like, he's mostly there to do the bad bear puns. And unlike Yosuke, his attempts at sort of going after women and stuff like that kind of comes across as more, oh wow, this guy's a real goofball and he has no idea what he's doing, but...
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I personally, I don't. I think he's his human form is cute, like physically, like, whoa, that's a hot boy. But like, otherwise, I don't actually find him that cute, and I don't find his pickup attempts that cute. I actually find them kind of depressing because it's like watching a 5-year-old hit on ladies because his dad does, right?
Oh yeah.
He hangs out with Yosuke a bunch. Yosuke hits on ladies in gross ways, so he does because it's a trained response, and it's really gross to me.
Yeah. Also, I guess it's on a darker level. That's probably him also trying to sort of make sure that he's never alone at any time.
I mean, I don't think there's a part of, like, I don't think there's a, like, if someone was receptive, I don't think he'd have the slightest idea what to do. I think he would shut down because he's like, these are just sort of like, it's like, oh no, and now you hit on the lady and she rejects you and it's funny and everybody laughs, ha 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 ha. And it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's
sad.
Yeah, it's, yeah, that stuff is weird again.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I feel bad for Teddy, but yeah, not one of my favorite characters.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you handle the next one, maybe?
Okay, yeah. So Naoto, they're kind of introduced to you as a, somewhat of a, they're introduced as this male police officer that's basically going around investigating the murders and...
Well, private investigator.
Private investigator, yeah. But, I guess that I got that confused because she's constantly working with the police. But, yeah, she ends up being taken, and through the Shadow Realm, they basically reveal that she's female and really, really, really wants to be accepted as male due to issues with, just dudes being dudes and being really aggressive and dismissive of women. So there's this whole arc about, there's a part where she's basically, her shadow anyway is like, oh yeah, I totally want to basically get a gender reassignment sort of thing and just be a dude. And eventually it kind of resolves to a point where it's like, oh no, I'm just kind of having trouble accepting that I can be respected and be female at the same time. But for me, I kind of read that differently, and it was kind of a point in my life where I was still sort of figuring things out. I kind of knew that I was sort of meant to be a girl and all that, but just seeing that character, and you think gay characters aren't super well represented in gaming or other media. Trans characters, almost nowhere. Like, even when Orange is the New Black came out, that's still such a rare thing. And it at that time, something sort of clicked, and it was like, this character really speaks to me in a number of ways, even if she ends up being like, yeah, I'm a woman and I'm okay with that. It's sort of this idea that, yeah, I can be more feminine, I can pursue this, and I can eventually sort of make the decision that, yeah, being a woman is my true self, more or less. Mm-hmm. And I guess I've kind of had trouble with this, coming to terms with the fact that she is really a female character and a woman, because the way that she's written, more or less, that's her arc, and saying otherwise would kind of be, that's not actually, it's basically not what the character actually is. Like, that's what she is as a character. But to me, she kind of became a sort of icon or role model for quite a bit of time. And it's one of those things where I kind of have to respect the fact that this character that comes from a very flawed history of there's a lot of trans characters in Japanese media that are or characters that sort of play around with the idea of gender, and the way that it's done kind of jumps between dismissive at the least, or incredibly grossly offensive at the worst. And yeah, just kind of, I cannot add to understand that this character wasn't really, this character was there when I needed them, and she's still an amazing character and all that. And I'm really, really happy for the strength that she gave me over the years. But it's one of those situations where you have to look at one of your favorite things and recognize, yeah, she's kind of imperfect and not what I was hoping for, more or less.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, like, so obviously, I mean, there, her storyline, the intention there is that she's, yeah, she's a girl who is working with the police department, and the police department is pretty sexist. And also, she's in Japan, which is pretty sexist. Hey, throwing that one out there. And so she's like, well, okay, I'm just desperate to be taken seriously. I guess I need to be a guy to do that. And I don't think that, like, that, like, that being her arc and that being sort of like the facts of what they were doing, I don't think that has any bearing on the merit of what she inspired you to and what you took away from it, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, okay, I guess that's the concrete, like, this is what they were writing. But, like, fucking, I don't know. I think characters are more than the facts of how they were written and what they're like, their story is more than their plot, if that makes sense, you know?
Yeah, like, they're the themes that stick out to you and you can really take away are so much more than what happens to them before, after, during that. Basically, it's a situation where one thing that we typically don't really get with media, or that we tend to dismiss within ourselves, is we can criticize something for being problematic. We can talk about how it's wrong for doing this sort of thing and wrong for doing that sort of thing, but ultimately, if there is something within that that you can take away, that you can sort of turn into something that really means something to you and something you love, then you shouldn't let the problematic bits of it essentially override or tell you you can't love that thing or you can't take that away.
Yeah, and I think that's, like, that's an important thing to say in discussing Persona 4, because, you know, if you've been listening to this podcast, there have been a number of points where we're like, boy, this is really, whew, boy, I wish they hadn't done this. I wish this didn't clearly reflect some pretty gross views on their point. Like,
yeah, and this is one of our favorite games ever. I think that's safe to say.
Yeah, no, I love this game, and there are a lot of parts of it that are really problematic, but it really, like, thematically, and, like, you know, some stuff, like, I would say, like the trans stuff, like, they touch on without really meaning to, but, like, I don't care what they meant to do. I care what this thing is, this creation independent of them, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. We've had a lot of thoughts on Naoto, I guess. You want to talk about the Dojimas a bit?
Sure. I'm going to butcher his first name. Ryotaro Dojima? Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah.
Ryotaro, yeah.
He's basically the person that you're more or less staying with. He's related to your family. You're kind of his, I think you're
his nephew.
Yeah, his nephew, yeah. And basically he kind of he's both a very dedicated family sort of person and a very dedicated to his job, but he doesn't really have a good balance of that. So there's times where he's just like, oh yeah, Nanako kind of has to take care of herself because I'm busy doing all this sort of stuff. And even when I get home, I'm usually too tired to hang out with her. But when there situations arise, whenever you or Nanako basically may be in danger or they might be getting into trouble, he takes a very protective stance and even though he can be very harsh and inquisitive, you always get the sense that he's doing that because he really takes his responsibility seriously as a parent, and he just wants to protect you the best way he can, sort of like he goes out on the job and tries to protect the people that he searches for and ultimately protects in the role of a police officer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like I empathize with him more than I used to now that I live, you know, in the same house as my nephews. Because like my nephew Finn, he and I get along pretty well. We hang out a lot, or I guess I should say we would like to hang out a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have a full-time job. The hours are not always convenient, and there are a lot of times when he'll come home from school and he'll be like, "Hey man, let's." Well, you know, I am ultra paraphrasing. I don't think he's probably ever said "Hey man," but here we go. He's like, "Hey man, let's hang out." I'm like, "I'm leaving for work in 15 minutes, and when I'm come back, you'll be in bed." And it's just kind of like, "Boy, like, what can you do, right?" Like,
yeah, totally.
Your job is your job, and you've got to do it. You got to pay the bills. You got to, you know. Not super lenient on that front. And Dojima is a single parent. His wife, Nanako's mother, died in a hit and run some time ago. And it's like, well, okay, you're working full time and raising a kid by yourself. Like, wow, that's really just not doable.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting to see the way that sort of implants on Nanako too. Like, she's used to disappointment, more or less, so sometimes she's just like, when you turn her down or when Ryotaro's going to bed or something, she's like, "Oh, okay." And she ends up watching a ton of TV. She loves reciting the Juness theme song. It's one of those situations mm-hmm. where you definitely get the impression that she... It doesn't seem like she's being raised improperly, but it does seem like the circumstances around her have shaped her in a certain way.
I mean, I think she's being raised improperly. And, like, I'm not going to point fingers at Dojima for that. I'm not going to get pissed at him for that, because obviously his situation is not good either. But, like, I mean, a lot of characters have reactions when you can't currently hang out with them, but they're still there as NPCs.
Mm-hmm.
And Nanako is that she's watching TV and she doesn't want to hang out. Nanako's is that she's like, this question on this quiz show is really hard, and she's just laser focused on it and is zoning you out. And that's not healthy.
Oh, yeah.
That's not good.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Like, yeah, I think she's got issues, and I think she's going to be okay. She's a good person. Dojima is a good person, and it seems like it's going to work out for them. But it's kind of a there but for the grace of God situation, honestly.
Yeah, it's she's definitely painted in the series as this sort of pure character that when she ends up being a target, she no sort of shadow comes out, and there's kind of a question about whether that's just her age or whether that's her personality. It honestly seems to be a mix of both.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it's one of the situations where she's sort of seen as the ultimate good and sort of both as related to her and living with her and recognizing how good she is. You kind of goes out of his way more or less to, or at least the way that I played it, he goes out of his way to protect her at all costs and is very protective in a, as Nanako would put it, big bro way.
Yeah, I won't go too deep on Persona 4 Arena, but that is absolutely canon, is that he's extremely protective of her. Yeah, like, I feel like if we saw Nanako's shadow, it would just be like her, like, staring and being like, "I wish Dad was a TV." And it's like, oh no. Then he couldn't run away and I could turn him on and off anytime I wanted and just watch TV. Like, boy, it's good. But her arcana in the game is represented as justice. which, yeah, is part of her being, like just a good person, but also kind of feels to me like, I don't think it'll ever come up, but if we saw Nanako in high school, I think that would be interesting.
Yeah, it's having a very, probably a sort of censor right and wrong sort of...
I sort of imagined her as the person who defends people from bullies, honestly.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking. And eventually grows up into being a lawyer or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, in this world, like, I mean, fucking Akihiko from Persona 3 grew into, like, basically Ryu from Street Fighter. He wanders around the world with a cape and no shirt and punches people. Maybe that would be Nanako.
Yeah. How great would it be if she was basically the new Phoenix Wright?
We can dream, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I think they're sort of not foreshadowing, because again, I don't think this will ever actually come up. But it's like, no, like she's gonna be like a good person, but a hard case when she grows up. She's gonna be a tough lady.
Yeah.
I guess I'll talk a bit about Adachi and Mitsuo, because I feel like they're kind of two of a kind on that one. Mitsuo is the kind of creepy other school student that gets kidnapped, and when you go to encounter him in the shadow world, and you encounter his shadow is basically just his absolute unwillingness to accept responsibility and grow up, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, it's a voxel manifestation of, like, basically, like, Dragon Warrior, you know, like the Dragon Quest games and stuff. And he is the only person, when faced with his shadow, who doesn't accept it. He rejects it again, and the shadow just kind of gives up. It's just like, okay, you're fucking hopeless. And, like, I feel like it ties into two things. It ties, like, a Western idea and an Eastern idea. It ties into the Western idea of millennials, right? That we're all, like, hey, me and Jen are both millennials. And there's this... I don't know if I'd say popular, but sort of the mimetic idea of a millennial is a person who, like, is sort of doesn't realize how good they have it and is wrapped up in their own little world and feels like everything should be served to them because they tried.
Yeah, I feel like that's a older person idea of us more than...
Sure, but that's like, I mean, even when we say millennial, that's usually what we mean. We're usually being mocking when we say it. But when we jokingly say fucking millennials, that's what we mean, you know?
Yeah.
And Mitsuo is kind of like the quintessential version of that, but he's also sort of the Japanese hikikomori phenomenon, which are basically like, they are usually younger people who have just kind of given up and are now shut-ins. Like, they'll buy their groceries off a line, usually with their parents' money. They're not going to get a job. They're just on the computer on the time. They've very rarely leave their room.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's a good contrast, because it's not the game being like these fucking young people, right? Because most of the other characters are young people and most of them are pretty cool.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like that is like, I don't agree with the stereotype of millennials, but I do agree that that sort of person certainly exists, right?
Yeah. That was actually the, not to bring a whole other game into this conversation, but the Silver Case actually touched on a very similar sort of situation, where these characters that were very much shut-ins would basically go on these message boards and obsess over this specific killer and talked about how cool and rad he was and how they kind of wanted to copycat him. And that actually happens in this game. Like, he basically decides, you know what, I want to... Well, he ends up actually killing someone, but he also takes credit for all the other deaths, more or less, at one point.
Mm-hmm. And how appropriate is it, then, that the actual killer, or I guess he actually didn't kill anyone, that's sort of the kicker, right, is that Adachi didn't successfully... No, I guess he killed one person, right?
Yeah.
But he actually didn't successfully kill, but for the one person. He tried with a lot of people. Is Adachi, and he's basically Mitsuo, but a little more grown up and way more driven, right? He out and out says, like, he, you know, well, he graduated from police academy, and he's so smart, and he's so talented, and they shoved him out here in the boonies, so fuck the world, I'm gonna do whatever I want. He's incredibly selfish, he's a huge misogynist, he's a tremendous piece of shit, right?
Yeah, like, it's actually cartoonish the way that he starts talking about women to the point where, my first exposure to this game was through Giant Bomb, and, Jeff had a lot of fun doing his, just sort of imitating his whole Adachi just goes, ugh, these bitches, man. And it's like, yeah, it's the point where you almost sort of, it's the point where you almost just sort of chuckling at how cartoonishly evil he is. Like, he doesn't really seem like a real person like some of the other characters do.
Well, and I'll get to that in a minute, but yeah, like, I mean, like, the meme, like, there is an Adachi meme, and it is an image of him with a crazy face and just the text bitches and whores. He's over the top, but there is a good reason for that, which is also kind of a bad reason for that. Adachi in the game, like, except for like the very last moments when you see him, he's sort of possessed. He's possessed by like an evil god, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, his last words in the game, not his very last words, but some of his last words are being like, yeah, I mean, like, the god took what I was thinking and how I felt and made it cartoonish and really stupid, right? Like,
yeah.
How over the top it is, I think, the god. But the basic thoughts are still his. And, like, he says, like, hey, like, yeah, of course, like, this god was possessing me and driving me to be a little more crazy. But, like, he basically says, don't let me off the hook for this one. Right?
Yeah, which is pretty crazy to admit in a way, like, just like in a situation like that, just being like, yeah, that's, I have to own up to that, that's kind of me.
Well, and I think, like, I mean, it is kind of crazy. It follows some Japanese, especially some Japanese anime tradition of, you know, like the Japanese idea of what it means to take responsibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't even totally agree with the, like, if you watch an anime and someone gets possessed, like literally possessed, loses all control of their body, mind controlled, and stabs someone, and then they're unpossessed, they'll be like, well, I guess I have to spend the next 3 years of my life like making up for this. It's like, no, that wasn't fucking you, man. You don't have to do that.
Yeah.
Is my personal perspective as an American. But like, yeah, like, it's not totally the same as that, because, yeah, like, he is, like, no, I was actually thinking that these are all bitches and whores, and I am actually, like, this person. And I guess I would say he's another character who gets some development into Persona 4 Arena, because in Persona 4 Arena Ultimax, he's out and about again, right? He's a villain, he's, like, initially the game presents him as the mastermind, right? Like, oh shit, Adachi's out again, no wonder things have gone bad. And that doesn't end up being the case. And basically, like, the way it presents it from his perspective, because you do get to a chance to play through the game as Adachi, and he's hanging out in jail, and someone comes and breaks him out, is like, come, help me with my evil scheme. And he's like, I kind of just wanted to do my time in peace and, you know, fucking think about what I'd done wrong and change my life. But I guess I'm here now, so I'll try and do what I can. So, I don't know, I think, like, the Persona series is generally so optimistic that even its most shitty person ends up getting saved, which is kind of nice and kind of cheesy. I don't know, I think it is interesting, though, to see it as, like, as the Persona developers commenting on, yeah, the Hikikomori phenomenon, and, like, the way people see, like, you know, people come out of college and are like, I guess, you know, like, I've got my degree, I should get a job now, right? That was kind of his attitude, was like, well, I've done all this work, I should now get a good job. And he doesn't, and he's really angry at the world for that. And the world doesn't say it as much as I do. I will say, I don't think he's totally wrong. I think it's fair for him to be angry at the world for how shitty things are in the world. But I guess the extra step he takes is then going like, well, like, I can't very effectively punish the world, right? It's the fabric of reality. I can't shoot it. I can't shove it into a TV. I guess I'll do that to the people around me. And that's, of course, the step too far.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think, yeah, after this, we've just got the other social links, which mostly, I mean, like, are there any you want to call out?
Not really. Most of these social links that I sort of focus on when I'm actually playing the game is the core group of friends, but I guess it's kind of nice just to have sort of a selection of side stories that you can go into sometimes, and that instead of being bogged down by also this supernatural element, or more complicated than that, it's mostly just teen high school stuff, and that can be kind of fun.
Yeah, and I think, like, I mean, it's the social links, I think, are, they're really hit and miss. There's some of them that I think are decently strong, and some that are, like, the fox, which is, you know, we talked about the fox in the first episode, the one who lets you heal when you're in the TV. He has a social link associated with him. It's not like it's, like, it's not unpleasant to read those scenes, but he's not really a character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are others that are just not very interesting stories. I guess the two that we should mention Marie very briefly from Persona 4 Golden. Actually, there's another thing I wanted to mention. I forgot. Let me back up for a second. In Persona 4 Golden, you get the chance to social link with Adachi. And I feel like that's one of the reasons I like him as a character, is because you get to, like, there is... He's treated like a normal person in those social links, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there is a degree to which that's an act on his part. But there's a degree to which it's not. And you just see a side of him where he's this, like, pretty smart, but kind of, like, clumsy and just sort of, like, feels lost in the world character who doesn't know what to do with his life. And I actually find him really pretty sympathetic, other than the fact that he's a murderer.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely one of those situations where throughout most of the game, you kind of feel bad for him because he's constantly working right next to Ryotaro, and it just feels like one of those situations where he sometimes just gets shat on just for being the one that's right next to Ryotaro at the moment, and and he does a great job of just in person taking that in stride, just like, oh, well, I guess this is my lot in life for now. And, yeah, it's, I guess that's one of the things that really makes him an interesting character. Just, he does a very convincing job, more than most other characters that have turns like that. And, well, in it, even though it seems to be like, oh, wow, I never really expected this from you. Also, it should, everything else that happened before also just feels like, yeah, I guess if I really, really thought about that, this is just another part of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like, well, you're like, you're this smart, but kind of like, kind of a little thoughtless sometimes, like definitely not a wise person, who seems to be getting kind of shat on by the world. Like, oh yeah, I guess actually, even given what I've seen, it kind of makes sense that you'd be pretty angry about the world. But anyway, moving forward, Marie is one of the social links we should mention, or Mari, or however you want to pronounce it. The game can't seem to make up its mind. She's like, she's supposed to be interesting and she's not. Can I say that? Is that fair?
I think so, yeah. It's a very well-worn trope, even more than some of the other tropes that they deploy throughout the series, and it's really hard to get away from the way that she's basically slid in there in Golden. It feels very much like the stereotypical, we got a chance to re-release this game, so here's some stuff that either was on the cutting room floor, or just stuff that we threw together because, hey, it's nice to have new stuff for this new version.
Yeah, she feels pretty tacked on. So she's a resident of the Velvet Room who is a tsundere, and she's like, she clearly likes the protagonist, but pretends she doesn't. And she's, oh, it's very cute that she... No, it's not cute. She's annoying. And basically, it's eventually revealed that she's like, the manifestation of a goddess that protects the town. And listen, I guess I get what you were trying to do, but I don't care about Marie.
Yeah.
I don't care.
And also, when you talk about that sort of revelation, it doesn't really make sense with the way that she acts most of the other time. Like, if she has some experience sort of protecting, then why does she not know anything, basically, about the...
Well, she's got amnesia about her identity.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Because, of course, she does, because... Let's move on.
Yeah,
Not a good character.
Yeah, there's a reason why I messed that up, because I didn't...
Because it just, in one ear and out the other, because who cares?
Yeah, basically.
I guess I will say, though, the one social link that I want to specifically point out is I really enjoyed the Sayako Uehara, who is the devil arcana. She's a nurse who works at the hospital, and you can get a job to basically be a janitor and work at the hospital at nights. And I think she's interesting in her own right, because she's really, like, kind of, like, she likes to tease. She's really, like, kind of, like, got a dark sense of humor, despite working at a hospital, but she's also pretty serious about her job and helping people, to the point that, like, as she gets stressed out later and later in the social link, she's kind of losing her temper on other hospital staff for not taking the job seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I just, like, one of the things I like best about, besides just all of that about her, which I think is really interesting, it also shows another side of you, Narukami, which I find really interesting, because, like, I am of the opinion, and I think the game sort of backs this up, that any option that the game pops up to choose is something that you considers doing. Like, that's something that he would think of. And you get a lot of options to flirt with Sayako. You get a lot of options. And the game is even, like, suggestive that maybe that, like, it's sort of, like, it really is pretty vague, but, like, there are points where it really suggests that maybe she, like, kissed you or something, right? There's some suggestion there. And I think, I don't know, it's really, like, it's an interesting representation of her, like, working at a really stressful job, but kind of, like, relieving some stress with the help of this, like, this kid who seems interested in her, and she's like, this seems like a good kid. He's still a kid, but, like, you're all right, kid. I don't know. That social link is really complicated and interesting.
Yeah. I didn't actually spend much time in that situation, but...
Oh, man, it's really pretty good. If you play through again,
yeah.
You should see that one all the way through. She ends up, like, deciding to like... She joins, basically, Doctors Without Borders. She has a whole thing. It's interesting.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that does sound like something I should look into.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, unless there's something else, that's probably it for characters, for this character episode.
Yeah, I can't really think of any other... We've kind of touched on all the major characters, more or less, unless you want to have a whole little bit on Funky Student or something.
he's pretty funky. No, I think we're good. Yeah, I think we're going to commit to doing a third episode, and that'll close us out for Persona 4. Does that sound good?
Yeah, I might need to spend some time brainstorming parts of it to put together.
Well, but... you don't need to tell them that. That's behind the curtain. They don't see that.
Okay, yeah, well, yeah totally. So we'll have... Third episode.
Sounds good. So we'll have a third episode on Persona 4 for you. I hope you enjoyed this one. If you did, hopefully by the time this goes up, we'll be on iTunes and Google Play and Stitcher and stuff. And you can go to the Scanline Talks feed and give us a rating or review, or tell your friends and, just spread the word. If you like what we do here, we both write for ScanlineMedia.com. It's a website that we run. We talk about games. And you can go there and check out our articles. If you like what we do, if you want to give us some help, you can go to patreon.com/scanlinemedia. And any money you give us will help us cover more things. It's not for profit. Thanks so much, everybody. And I guess we'll see you next episode.
Don't overthink it.
Indeed.